I'm Scott, I'm an alcoholic. And this reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories described in their own language and from their own point of view, the way that they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Tonight's speaker is my lovely wife, Chris, all the way from Gainesville, Georgia. I give you Chris.
Hey, my name's Chris. I'm an alcoholic. In my marriage, I'm the one that got all the words. So Scott has a few. They're usually really powerful when he speaks. We should listen. But I'm the one that talks a lot. So I'm going to share more than that tonight. First of all, it's an honor to be here. Tim swooped me up. It was March 2nd of this year. I had gone to a 7:30 meeting that I don't normally go to in Gainesville at the Halt Club, which is kind of the NABBA of Gainesville, and to pick up my 17-year chip. And I had not been to that meeting before. And for whatever reason, this particular year was really special to me. And it just, every once in a while, there's a year that just really, really hits hard. And this was one of them. And I, oddly enough, this weekend had to go to a funeral out east of Atlanta where we used to live for somebody that I was in sobriety with some years ago. And came back driving through all of the neighborhoods that I both got drunk and got sober in. And it just was one of those kind of sweet moments when you look back. And there was a time in my life where I really took the Janis Joplin approach to drinking. It's like drink hard, drink fast, drink all that you possibly can and die really young. That was kind of my goal. That was if I had a mission statement, that's what it would have been. And it turns out that I'm tougher than I realized, and I wasn't dying fast enough. And so the consequences were really beginning to catch up with me. And so as I'm driving through all these neighborhoods and towns and stuff where I both drank and got sober, the memories are mixed. You know, some of them are bananas. Some of them are crazy. And a lot of them, thanks to Alcoholics Anonymous and rooms like this actual one, because my home group used to be behind that curtain 17 years ago. There's a big book study back there where I learned a whole lot about what this thing really means. And thanks to places just like this, that story that I thought was going to end one way has gone on and on and on in a very, very different way. And I am so, so grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous because the story that I have, the one that's worth telling, the one that people ask me to speak for, is certainly not the one that got drunk on the streets of Atlanta and lived in a bunch of hotel rooms and was really bad at selling drugs. Like, that's not really the interesting part. Although if you had asked me then, I would have told you that I was the rebel without a clue, that I was the one that kind of got it, and the rest of the world really didn't get it. And I was so deep and meaningful that I just couldn't function in the world with other people. And it turns out I was wrong, one. And it also turns out that those people weren't suckers. They were actually doing it right. And it turns out that I really wanted to grow up to be just like them. I just didn't know how. I started drinking very early to fix this thing in me. There's a favorite song I have that says, I was born with an abundance of inherited sadness. And I always love that line. It's just a good line because that pretty much describes my early life. I came from a family tree, latent with alcoholism. You know, just everywhere, the uncle, the brother, the cousin, the mom, the sister, everybody was either alcoholic or raised by one, and so they got all the isms. And so we're pretty much a bunch of blind leading the blind into a world where the blind were leading the blind, leading the blind. And I was born into all of that. And so I'm grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm more than grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. I owe a debt of gratitude that I'll never really be able to repay because the doors were open here when they were not open anywhere else. I'm hard-headed, really stubborn, and I rode the horse to the ground and then beat the horse to death and tried to drag it along for a little while with this whole drinking thing because it was fixing that thing in me. And I thought really that people like me, I didn't really say alcoholic, but I knew that I was one. People like me just had to put up with the kind of consequences that I had to put up with in order to not have to face what happened in my mind and in my heart when I was not drinking. And so driving through all those roads and all those memories and stuff, and what really happened is that everything truly interesting that I've ever done in my life, which has been many things at this point, has happened as a result of a beginning in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and working the steps with people who knew how to do that. So I'm so grateful to Tim for asking me to do this. It was a good trip down memory lane coming down here. I'm kind of getting settled in. We have two little kids and three big. We call them the bigs and the littles. I have three older stepchildren and two small children, 7 and 3. And so the journey to get here today started at 2 this afternoon in order to shuffle children to Gigi's house in Johns Creek or drive down from Gainesville, go to Johns Creek, pick up the husband in Duluth, and then finally make it to some really good Mexican food, and then to make it to y'all. So as I settle in, I go, okay, I really am just an Uber driver with a ring on. That's really my job. And that's what I do. And I try to do it with some joy in my heart, thanks to what we learn how to do in here. And so honestly, now when I get to get up to speak, I'm just super underneath all of it. It's all honor and all of that, blah, blah, blah. I'm really just happy I get to be alone with adults for like a couple of hours. There's a small happy dance, and all the moms are cracking up because that is the small happy dance that happens when moms and Alcoholics Anonymous get to go to a meeting by ourselves. I'm never alone anymore. And I didn't know what that was going to mean when I first heard it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was all about God and you. Turns out you're just really, you get married and you get sober and all those things happen. You have children and then you're just literally never by yourself. So thank you for being here for my alone time, my mommy and me time. So the truth is my story starts way back with a lot of other people's stories. Just like I said, I came into an alcoholic family. I was raised by an alcoholic. And I didn't discover that, I didn't really have this realization until later on. But my mom, who didn't drink, has all of the isms. She has all of the things that we do because she was raised by an alcoholic. But I always thought of her as somebody who didn't drink. I always thought of her as somebody not like me, although she understands this thing in a very deep way, a very visceral way. I was born in Tennessee, a little town, now not so little, Knoxville in 1980. And they divorced fairly early on because of drinking. It was a violent and unkind house where things happened that should not happen in any home. And that is not an original story in this room. It turns out a lot of us are that way. And it started a trend of aloneness that would continue throughout my drinking. We lived in the same little apartment. My mom's answer to all that chaos was to get really, really small. So we lived in the same tiny little apartment for the next 11 years, and we did the same thing every week. the week was for working and schooling, and you would come home and you would watch TV and you would eat the macaroni and cheese with the cut up hot dogs, and then you would get up in the morning and you would do it again. Like that was that, and then the weekends were for getting ready to do that again, for the laundry and all of the things. And my mother loves me fiercely and deeply, and she healed as much as she could from what she was given. She kicked the ball of healing down the field in such a way that I was able to carry it forward, I think, a little bit more. So we got real small, and I am not a small person. I am loud. I use a lot of words. I talk with my hands. I laugh too loud. I am just too much. I'm too much for a tiny little apartment in a tiny little town in a tiny little place. I wanted more. I wanted more than that. I wanted noise and excitement, and I wanted all the things, and my mom was kind of had the reins on trying to hold me back. You know, I wanted to be a part of things, and my mom, for her, the world is a scary, scary place, and people are too much, and so that was all too much noise. And I got the memo really early on that I was too much, just too much. We were there for 11 years, and then she met a man who became my stepfather, who I despised. And I didn't really hate him. I just hated everything he stood for and the fact that he was a man. You know, small things. And I didn't want anything to do with anything. And they got married. They were truly in love, deeply in love. Wonderful, wonderful marriage. And I grew to love him over time. And also, thanks to what we do in here, I healed a whole lot and was able to learn how to love somebody like that. But that took a long and winding, twisting road. So at this point, I just hate him. And we move here, and there's this big old hole in me. And I remembered a time, and my first drink was really when I was six. My parents then were bikers, and they would hang out with bikers, and bikers drink out of long neck bottles. And I learned at six, if I went around the circle enough times and took enough sips, I started to get that real nice feeling in my chest. It was nice and warm. I remembered that when everything went pear-shaped, and I went looking for an answer. And I always drank to fix that. Like I said, I always drank to fix this thing, this being different thing. And so when we moved to Atlanta from Knoxville, I did not want to come. I tried every way and means that a 12-year-old has, which is about three, and most of those are pitching a fit, to not come here. And I wanted to live with anybody else, do anything else, be anybody else. And none of that worked. So we moved here, and I promptly found everybody who drank like I wanted to, like I thought I wanted to. And I was completely sold on this whole lifestyle. For me, drinking was not just the bottle. It wasn't just what happened. It wasn't just that warm and fuzzy thing. But it was also the group of people that I found belonging with. It was a mission and a purpose. It was rebellion. It was a lifestyle for me. And I chose it willingly and was willing to do anything I needed to do to keep that going. At the ripe old age of 12, you know, I was completely sold. Like I said, Janis Joplin, that was the trajectory I was on. I quickly became a blackout drinker, which is difficult to do. I mean, I look back now and think that took a lot of talent to figure out ways to blackout drink when you're a preteen. You know, by 15, I was actively a blackout drinker. Every time I drank, I blacked out, which starts to get scary. That starts to be a bit terrifying. And so I fixed that. I fixed that the only way I knew how. I added more chemicals. And then I became this kind of chemical garbage can that all started with drinking. And I just became a chemist who tried to manage this crazy. Because I was always fixing. I was always trying to be anybody other than myself. And that is a painful way to exist, especially in teenagehood. And that kept going for longer. You know, all of our stories are the same. It always keeps going long past the time where you think it ought to stop. My stepdad, Robert, who she married, was also a workaholic. That's what we did. We worked. And then on the weekends, you got ready to work some more. And you did the laundry so you could go back to work on Monday. So nobody's really watching. Like, nobody's paying any attention. And at the point in time where my drinking got in the way was when that started to disrupt the thing we did. We had a thing. You clean, you vacuum, you go to work on Monday. You do the laundry, you go to work, you make the dinner, you go to sleep, you get up, you go to work. When my drinking started to disrupt that system in the house, then it was time to do something about it. And I was 17 by then, and I was angry. I was so angry. And I was angry at the world. I was angry at me. I was angry at the wind blowing. I was just an angry creature. I decided to take my anger out on all of you, and I walked in anger. I had a purple mohawk and a kilt and some combat boots, and I kicked trash cans. You know, I was the after school special of anger. That's pretty much what I looked like. And I just walked around in the world pissed off, you know, and drinking would kind of ease that. I found people who were, I never got less angry. I just found people who were as angry as I was, and we would party. You know, that was what I did. But early on in my drinking, I was still a little different. At 15, there was never enough. And that wasn't true for all of the other angry mohawked people I was hanging out with. Because when the booze would run out for them, the party would kind of fizzle. When the booze would run out for me, I would go find a homeless man with a jar of clear liquid and I would drink it. Like that was the, I would send people out into the world to find whatever booze was left, and I would drink whatever came back to the hotel room or the apartment. I would drink it all up because there was never, ever, ever enough for me. Always drank till blackout. Always drank till I passed out. I could never tell you what was going to happen. Occasionally I would have one. That was rare. And it would always set into motion, and I heard this in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'd never heard it before. It would set into motion this train of thinking where that one drink, although I could say I only had one that day, it would set into motion this thing that would happen where I could not think about anything else. And I didn't hear that about that. That was one of those first things I heard in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went, "Whoa, you guys do that too?" you know what I'm talking about. That strange, what I know now is the mental twist. I didn't call it that then. I just knew that I had to follow that wherever it led. If it led to another state, if it led to another apartment, if it led to a group of strangers, that really was irrelevant. That's how I was going to drink. Going to treatment, I was absolutely not convinced that I was an alcoholic. I didn't even really want to talk about that word. I was not convinced that I was a drug addict or anything like it. I knew I was crazy because I had to do weird things like wear headphones to sleep because the noise inside my head was far too loud to function. I would pace and count and do all these odd things when not drinking. You know, I thought that I was medicating my crazy quite well. But I did, a seed was planted. There were people who were living differently, and I met them. And if I told you the truth then, which I wouldn't do for a lot of years, I liked them. I wanted to be with them. I didn't know how. I didn't know how to love people. I didn't know how to let people in my life. I was angry, and I was staying angry. Thank you very much. But there was something really attractive about this group of people. The big thing was that they were laughing. They laughed a lot. They would go places and talk, and they would laugh. They would smoke a lot of cigarettes, which I appreciated at the time because I smoked a lot of cigarettes too. And they would stand in parking lots and just laugh, like from their belly. And I thought, that's interesting. I didn't laugh a lot. Nothing was funny. I didn't stay sober then, and I, at the time, would have told you that what I had was sobriety. What I know now, because I have the other version, is that I was dry. I was okay as long as I was with them. I was okay as long as I was with you. If I was in a meeting, if I was standing on the porch after a meeting, the squirrels in my head would settle down, and I could kind of hang out. So I learned how to be cute on the front porch at Triangle and tell lots of jokes, smoke lots of cigarettes, drink all the coffee that I could. And then eventually, we would go to that party, we'd go until 2 in the morning at Denny's. I just kind of treated sobriety like I did booze. You know, I'd like going to a bar. I would go to a meeting and suck the joy out of you and borrow it for a little while to kind of patch up the hole in my soul. And then I would stay. I just never knew how to leave. I would stay and stay and stay until there was nobody left to hang out with, which, by the way, is exactly how I used to party. I would just stay and stay and stay. I was like the movie Dude, Where's My Car? I was the dude on the couch. You know, I just would never leave because I could never, like, unplug. I always needed that fix. And the fix was often booze, but it was also the people. It was the noise. It was the chaos. It was the stuff. It was the, I got to go here to meet this guy to fix this thing, to do this thing. And once I do that, my life will be great, right? And as long as I could make the list, it kind of was, you know, like as long as I had the idea, the master plan of how I was going to fix all this crazy and keep the party going and keep the thing going, then I could kind of fool myself into feeling like I was getting somewhere. But eventually the party goes away. It gets quiet, which I did not like, and I would be alone. And that happened in Alcoholics Anonymous too. Eventually everybody would go home. Eventually I had to leave Denny's or Waffle House or wherever it was we were, and the squirrels would come back in my head and I couldn't think straight and I was insane. And what I know now is that I was dry. I did not understand that then. I thought that I was trying Alcoholics Anonymous. I joke now and call it Diet AA. I really did the parts that were easy or convenient. I could hang out. I could chair a meeting. I could read stuff. We did crazy stuff like start the speaker meeting at Triangle. You know, we'd do all this noise, But there was no recovery in here. There was no change. The same person will drink again. And eventually circumstances happened. I got into a car accident. Some stuff got stolen. You know, the chaos that happens to people like us. Some of that stuff bubbled up and happened. And I had no tools. No tools. And a year before that, that would happen again, you know, and the year before that, that happened before, you know, it just kept, circumstances would happen. I would throw my life up in the air, get drunk and hope that it would land better than it was before. And it never did. I just kind of moved sideways. New apartment, new friends, new taste in music, new favorite color to go with whatever boyfriend I had at the time. And what's your favorite color? I don't know. What's yours? It'll be mine too. And I would just try on different identities, you know. I just wouldn't kind of, what identity you want me to put on? I'll wear that. And I got very, very good at that. I was an excellent, excellent chameleon. And I could read you. I knew what you wanted to hear from me. And that would allow me to be a part of whatever you were doing so I could suck some joy out of it, get real drunk, use your drugs, and then move on down the road to the next group of people. Like, so I don't have any long-time friends to come in here. I don't have people talk about like the people I knew from kindergarten, and I kind of laugh because I don't have any of those. I don't know anybody from high school or the three that I went to. I never kept those groups of people because they were always a means to an end. They always were. And AA for a time was the same way. I treated you like I treated everybody else. So I go back out. I discovered that I could fix the alcohol problem with a healthy dose of methamphetamine, and that addiction really did. That was the one time I actually fixed my blackout drinking, was by becoming a meth addict. Yeah, I don't recommend that path, but it does fix the blackouts. And then I was just awake for 10 or 20 days at a time. You know, that will really make you crazy. And about a year period, I did everything that I thought was never going to happen. I became the person that we were talking before the meeting. There was always somebody worse. I was always looking for somebody a little worse than me, or a group of people a little worse than me, because then whatever I was doing was kind of acceptable. It's like, at least I'm not that guy. Like, I'll do this, but at least I'm not you. I can still hold a job. I was always rationalizing and justifying. Well, that slope is slippery. And I remember one time I was sleeping in my car. I'd been living in my car for a while. Like I said, I'm a terrible, terrible drug dealer. I'm really, really bad at it, for all the reasons that you can imagine. And so sometimes there was money and sometimes there wasn't. But oftentimes I would end up sleeping in my Honda CRX, which, if you've never seen a Honda CRX, is about as big as this podium. It's a very, very small car. And I still, to this day, remember what it feels like. The bar in the back, it's kind of a hatchback with no seats in the back. And that was my castle. And I remember I was parked under a bridge not too far from here. It was Shallerford Road area. And I remember looking up and being like, oh, no, I'm under a bridge. And that moment happened. And then I thought, but I'm in a car under a bridge. So I'm still okay. I got this. I'm all right. And I believed that. I believed that. I mean, we talk about not being able to differentiate the true from the false. I thought, oh, I'm still all right. And I remember taking deep breaths, like, I can make it another day. But I remember, too, when I got arrested, stupid stuff. I should have been arrested for a lot worse stuff. God had a plan for me that I did not know. There was grace that I did not understand. Because what I should have gone to prison for, and what many people I was spending time with did go to prison for, was much, much bigger than the MP3 player. This tells you how long ago this was. The MP3 player that I stole from Walmart. And I was about this narrow. And the MP3 player was about this wide, because they packaged them in those big boxes and I had it under my shirt, which made me look oddly shaped. I don't know how I got caught. You know, I had a kind of square sticking out of my hoodie and pretty much had junkie tattooed on my forehead and reeked of booze. And so I'm walking out of the Walmart like, nobody's going to catch me. I don't look suspicious at all. So I promptly get handcuffs put on me, and I remember telling myself the truth just for a split second, because I cried because I was so grateful that I couldn't do it again tomorrow. I knew I couldn't stop. I knew that nothing in me was going to be able to stop this madness that was going on. I was just waiting to die and trying real hard. And I was real angry that I kept waking up the next day. But when those handcuffs went on, it was like safety from myself. Because I had gotten to a place where I didn't trust my own mind. at all. I knew that I was dangerous to you and to me, and I felt safe from myself for the first time in a year at that point, but probably if I was telling the truth most of my life. Now, I promptly got to jail and started trying to get out because that's what we do. You know, that moment is fleeting. I did not get sober that day. I tell this in my story because I think it's important. I didn't get sober on the days that anybody else thought I ought to get sober. You know, the days you almost die, the days where the car accident happens, the day you go to jail, the day that the crazy happens. And none of those days mattered at all. They were just the next in the series of garbage that somebody like me, I used to say that a lot, somebody like me has to live like. The day that I got sober was March 2nd, 2002, and it was Groundhog Day. It was just like all the other days. I had decided that the answer was in Florida, because if you're going to be homeless, you might as well be homeless on the beach. Makes total sense to me. Except I could never get more than like 50 or 60 miles outside of Atlanta, because I kept having to turn around and go back and fix something. And so I kept going back and forth and back and forth. So the farthest I got was Brunswick, Georgia. That's as close to Florida as I managed to get. And my captain of industry mind was really, really proud because the license plate on my car, which obviously I had not paid anything like taxes in a long time, ran out in June, and I thought that I was a mastermind because I had scratched it so perfectly out and written an A, which gave me till January, 6 more months. That's all I needed. And I thought I was a genius. And I'd done it in a Waffle House parking lot. I was not totally there. And about 25 minutes later, I got pulled over and almost went to jail. And then I thought I was a mastermind because I talked my way out of that with all of my worldly possessions and 2 homeless men in my Honda CRX. We were going to Florida, and we were going to fix this. And we wound up in Brunswick in a trailer of a woman I didn't know. And I was running out of master plans. And March 2nd, I had what we call in here, I did not remember this. I thought it was something that applied to other people, but I had a white light experience that day. And I was sitting outside this trailer of people I didn't know who were not kind and nor helpful. And everything got quiet, which was special for someone like me because my head had been going since I was 4. And it got really still. And a voice that was not one I was familiar with, because there were many up here at that point in time, a voice I knew was a power greater than myself, I knew it was God, said, "If you don't leave now, you're never going to." And I knew if I went back in that trailer, I was going to die, without question. So I left the last duffel bag worth of stuff that I had in the trailer, and I drove. But I was crazy. So I drove to a meeting I thought I had been to once in Savannah. I couldn't find it. And you know, people are driving around the streets like this. I think about that a lot. I'm like, somebody is out there like I used to be. Let me put on my 3 seatbelts, you know. This was nuts. I was driving around and I stole the last tank of gas I've ever had to steal. And I prayed my first prayer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I prayed while I stole the last tank of gas. And I said, "If you let me get away with this God I just met, then I promise I will go pick up a white chip." And I didn't know where to go, so I went back to Triangle, which is not close to Brunswick, in case you were wondering. It's not the first meeting that you come to on the highway. Like, it's kind of a drive. And we talked the whole way. And that feeling of the presence of God would not leave me it's never left me. It's changed. I've done work and we've grown in a relationship, but I was rescued from the gates of hell. No doubt. And I did. I went and picked up a white chip at Triangle, which is not far from here. And I always thought NABA was like where the grown-ups go. Like, at Triangle's is where you can't be weird, which is why it was my home group. And I went to the 10 o'clock meeting there, which we lovingly called the squirrel cage, because you never know what's going to happen there. And I'm pretty sure it's still like that now. And people would break into song or poetry. We had it on the front porch, you know, in the summertime. But this was March, and in March, that meeting used to get really small. There was only maybe 5 people in there. A woman named Catherine gave me my white chip. I showed up about halfway through, and I left. I was shaking. I didn't know how to be around people, and I slept in my car the last time that I've had to so far. God willing, I'll never have to do that again. I covered up with clothes that I had in the back seat, and I went to my family's condo. They lived in a condo. But I didn't knock on the door. I felt like I had given up my right to just show up and say, everything's going to be okay. I got this. I'm going to go get sober. I got this. I'm going to meetings now. I felt like I was lower than whale's belly. I just didn't feel like I belonged in the world at all. And the next day I went to Triangle, and I lived at that meeting. If I wasn't at work, I started to piece the things together, all the craziness. I used to sling booze for a living, and so I slung coffee. Starbucks will hire anybody, and they hired me. And I was lucky because the shifts were short, and I could stand up for that long before I needed to go take a nap. But if I wasn't at work, I was at a meeting. I did not have a date book. I was not important. I was lucky that I went to the, I remember going to the DMV, terrified that there was a warrant still out for my arrest, terrified, shaking. You know, I called everybody in my sobriety circle at the time. I said, if you don't hear from me, like, this might be why. But I was just barely a human. You know, barely crawling up out of the ooze, and the people there took care of me. They did crazy things like take me to Goodwill and buy me $60 worth of clothes, because that's where I started. It's very humbling when you have to borrow underwear. That's a humbling place. Or get that awesome piece of paper that says I'm indigent from the Department of Labor. That's a fun spot to be in. So that's where I started. Went to a lot of meetings. A lot of meetings. I went to a lot of big book studies and step studies, because I would sit in open discussion meetings and I could hear what you were saying, but none of it would stick. It would just kind of float through my head. And it was like borrowing your feel good, but I knew that wasn't going to work. And I got with a group of women who said, there's a practical program of action I think you've been missing. And it was like, I couldn't have heard it till I was ready to hear it, but the lights went on. I understood that there was a difference between the fellowship and the practical program of action, and that I had only been doing one. So my failure at AA was not AA's failure. It was my failure and my lack of readiness to understand that I needed to put some actual change in here, or I was going to be the same person and I was going to keep drinking again over and over and over again. I was going to keep messing up my life, blowing it up, doing the same pattern over and over and over again, unless I could change that trajectory. And the steps, big book studies, 12 and 12s, was how I learned how to change the trajectory. I became everything that a big book thumper is. I thought everybody needed this, and I was going to chase you down the street with it and tell you how it worked. You know, I was super fun to be around. I was awesome. I was the life of the party, you know, because that's how I drank. I drank to extreme. I got sober to extreme. I did all of the things because I really, really thought somewhere deep inside me that I could get an A in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that would result in a perfect, unchaotic life. I thought that was true. I didn't ever tell anybody that, but I thought if I could highlight enough sentences and memorize enough of this and then be able to quote it to you, and I was genuine, I was deeply genuine, I wanted to be sober so bad. But then everything went pear-shaped. You know, I stayed sober. One day at a time, I stayed sober. But then things, you know, you hear stories a lot in the rooms. I hear it now. I hear it in my home group all the time. And I love all of these stories are true. Our life sucks. What happened? We got sober. What it's like now. My life is awesome. You know, like everything is great. I got the job I always wanted. I got the woman or the man or the both or whatever it is your dream is. And so it's all everything that I ever imagined. And then it didn't turn out like that. You know, I married the love of my life, who I did meet in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was not a 13th step. We were both very sober. We both had sponsors. We both had worked steps. It was everything that the 12 and 12 talks about when boy meets girl on AA campus, but an actual, this is a scam likely, I apologize. That it was two sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous coming together and building a life. Is what we did. But we were still alcoholics, and we both had about 5 years sober, so we're still pretty nuts. And so we get married in a big AA wedding where everybody involved was in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was fantastic. And then we proceed to, like, I'm going to college, we open a business, I become the stepmother of three children, we decide to buy a house, all of this in 6 months. Like, what could go wrong? Like, this is definitely going to work out great. And I look back now and think that's insane. Like, who does that. But at the time, I was getting up every day, praying the prayers, doing the thing. I was sponsoring. I was going to meetings. I was doing all this stuff. And what could go wrong? I was asking for God's will, and it was all going to be great. Because when you get sober and you work some steps and you get this bed of roses, right? Well, then the market turned and we were undercapitalized. And so the business, we had to close the business. We almost lost the house. The three stepkids who I had decided to love and with all of my heart did an inventory and decided I was marrying the man of my dreams. But I wasn't just marrying him. I was marrying them too and opened my heart to them. They don't like me. Like, that's not about me. That took me a lot of years to get to. But they don't. They didn't want a stepmom. That's the truth of the matter. So I didn't get the Beeve and Cleave family that I thought 12 steps was going to give me. We ended up not losing the house, but it was by the skin of our teeth, and we had to work so, so hard. But this is what is really special about Alcoholics Anonymous. Because what Bill actually said, and the part I missed because I didn't really want to look into it this close, is that this is the way of living that works in rough going, which is a promise. It's not the promise I like. It's not my favorite. Like, what it is a promise that there will be rough going. I didn't like that one. But in the midst of all of that, we picked up all this mess we had made, this beautiful, beautiful mess, and AA taught us how to laugh through it. Taught us how to cry through it, taught us how to keep showing up through it, taught us how to do the next right thing through it. And then for the next 5 years, it was pretty pear-shaped. Those teenagers who grew up with all of the isms and all of the things, we walked through 4 teenage pregnancies. We buried our Lily Grace after 21 days of living. My dad died. We had the house that we bought that we were going to remodel, and it was broken, and we didn't have the money to fix it. Everything was sideways. I'll tell you the magic, though. I remember those years as years of joy. I don't remember them as how did we make it through. I don't remember them as broken years or wasted years. During that time, God dealt with me and Scott in whole new ways, and he was able to do that because we had sponsors, because we had meetings, because we kept praying together every day, because thanks to the steps that we knew how to turn towards each other and work together rather than turn on each other. We learned how to do every single bit of that, every single step in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and with the people who we met who had walked through tough things before, who said, you can make it through this, you can do this, because I have done it. And I just was crazy enough to believe. I stayed sober sometimes because I was curious. You know, I thought, well, I know what I was getting before. I have no idea where this mess is going to go, but maybe it'll go somewhere new. And I'll tell you, the magic happened in AA, not at year one or year five or the day we got married and it was all going to be great. The magic happened at like year 10 when we kept walking. And I got a story worth telling, because that God I had shaken hands with all those years before had carried me through something real, something hard. I learned how to grieve in Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know how to do that. People like me run, you know. So time goes by. We save the house. In the midst of all of that crazy, because this is the craziness that God does, we looked at each other one day, and we were closing the business. It was the doors were going to close the next day. And I looked at Scott, and I said, well, what have you always wanted to do? Because we got nothing right now. So if you ever wanted to move to Alaska or go to Texas or try your hand at chili, like whatever it was that you dreamed about when you were 5, now is the time because we got nothing. Like we can do whatever we want. That is Alcoholics Anonymous talking. Because this alcoholic would have said, F you, you caused all of this. This is all your fault. And I am out of here. I'm going to go find Mr. Right now in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much. I'm not going to drink, but I'm going to make a big mess out of my life. I didn't. I stayed with my best friend. I stayed with the man I had chosen, and we worked at it. And he looked at me and he answered honestly, because he has a God of his understanding and a program that he does with his sponsor, and we came together and he said, you know what, I always wanted to be an engineer. And we embarked on a journey that can only happen in Alcoholics Anonymous because both of us started out homeless before we came in here. And we worked to put him through Georgia Tech. And at 40 years old, he graduated with honors from Georgia Tech. Like, that can only happen in here. That's magic. You cannot get from where we were to where we are. So we graduate from Georgia Tech. That's a long, long road and a long story. In the midst of that, because we are crazy alcoholics, we added two more children to the mix. And a few years ago, we moved up to Gainesville. And I'll tell you, we came through the pear-shaped years just fine. We came through them in such a way because of what we do in here, and because of sponsorship, because of book, because of steps, because of working with steps more than once, many, many, many times, from learning how to use an inventory to diagnose what's happening with me, to clear out the trash so that I can get a connection with the God who I've really learned how to serve. That was not a word I liked when I got sober. And this crazy thing happened. I looked up one day in this meandering road that I've been on for so long. There was a time when I was drinking, and I had found myself on Shallowford Road in another dangerous situation where I almost died, and I would have walked off. I walked up Shallowford Road, and then I don't know how it is now, but back then Shallowford Road was not where a single white female wanted to go walking by herself. It just was not. And I was alone and all of the things, and I walked up to a hotel. I use that term loosely. and I met a man named Moses. Of course, his name was Moses. I could not make this up if I wanted to. And he worked there. And for whatever reason, Moses was kind. I don't know what he was doing there, except God had an angel for me. And he let me in to the front of the hotel, which that was not a hotel where you did that. And he let me sit down. He let me use the phone. And he asked me, he said, what is it that you really want? And I don't know why I answered him, honestly. I didn't tell anybody the truth. I didn't even know the truth. My favorite color was always, what's yours? I didn't know what I wanted. I wanted to not hurt. Those were the answers that I really would have given. But I said something that night. I said, I want to live in a little house with some animals on a hill. And I want to see the sun come up. And I want to be safe. And I want to feel whole. I said all this to a total stranger. And so we stay sober, and one day at a time, we sell that house. We moved to Gainesville a couple years ago and fell in love with this little property, and we started working on it and making it whole. And my husband has a job he loves today, which is watching somebody you love do learn and do and grow in a way that lights them on fire is one of the biggest gifts Alcoholics Anonymous has ever given me. Getting to be not just the superstar, but getting to be the cheerleader for a superstar is something I learned how to do in here. Because the alcoholic me would have said, but what about me? You know? But I looked out, and we had done some work on this property, and I looked up, and this was fairly recently. It was in the last couple of years. And that memory came back to me. I hadn't remembered it in a long time, and it hit me that God had brought me all this meandering way, ways that I didn't understand, through pain that I didn't want to go through. And I was standing in the spot that I told Moses that I always wanted to be. I live there now. I live there. I fed goats this morning. I have chickens who lay colored eggs because why not have fancy chickens? I have children today who have never seen me drink. I have stepchildren who don't know they're going to love me one day, but they will. They've decided not to. It's their business. And I learned how to accept that too. I love people fiercely today, and I know how to let people love me. And the craziest thing happened while I was standing there looking out over this little farm, this little 4 acres that is probably small to a lot of people, but it's heaven to me. I wake up every day and pinch myself and think a lot of times, you know, we read those 9-step promises and we say, are these extravagant promises? And we all say, we think not. And I say, yeah, you bet your ass they are. Like, those are extravagant. People like me should have died in a dumpster without a name. Like, that is an extravagant way to live. Feeding goats and there is always food in my refrigerator, and children who know how to laugh and did not inherit sadness. They have not inherited sadness. My children don't know fear. They don't know what it's like to wake up to people screaming and throwing things. They don't know what it's like to be abused. They don't know what it's like to have booze in the house all the time. They don't know any of those things. And that is a result of what we do in here. It's not a magic formula. I'm not special. Like, I feel pretty damn special, but I'm not. I'm not special. When I surrender to this process, and over the years I've had the privilege of working with so many women, the ones who completely surrender, and the men my husband has worked with, the ones who surrender, who just do it because there's nothing else to do, all of our stories come out the same. There'll be another pear-shaped time, I guarantee you. Things will go sideways. Stuff will not work out the way that I want it to. The dreams I have changed. They're not what I thought they would be. I had big, huge dreams, and it turns out I really like baking bread for tiny people who help me and make a big, big mess. Turns out I like being Uber for soccer. Turns out I like taking little kids to camp. That would have sounded, honestly, if I told you the truth, if you had told me that, if my sponsor had said, one day you will love being a stay-at-home mom. Not only would I have laughed, but I probably would have run in the other direction and said, if that's what recovery has to offer, you can keep it. It turns out it fits just right. That's the crazy thing about AA, is that the world didn't change. I did. I'm different. I gave myself a chance to be curious, ask a lot of questions. And if I do one thing right, I think that it's the willingness to do the little thing. Because I don't think, just like drinking, it wasn't the big days that got me sober. It wasn't the almost dying or the car accidents or even the going to jail. It wasn't the crazy out of my mind times. It was the day where nothing happened, where I could hear. In a strange way, I think I've come to believe that sobriety is the same for me. It's the little things. It's the thousand little things. It's saying yes when I don't want to, when it's inconvenient. It's picking up the phone when I think, God, I want to do anything else but talk to a crazy newcomer. God, they're annoying. It is staying after the meeting and making coffee. It's unlocking doors. And then it's bigger than that. It's calling and telling the truth to my sponsor when I think, I should be more sober than this. I should already know the answer. I should already know how to do this. It's maintaining that little bit of humility that says, hey, I'm still learning. I'm still a work in progress. I don't know everything. One of the things I didn't know, because I was a big book thumper who worshipped the process. You would get in the process, the practical program of action. There's a pie chart for this. I could draw it for you, but I won't. And I was obsessed with this. You know, like all the answers that I need are in here. But I missed a line. I thought it only applied to people in 1935, where it said, be quick to see where religious people are right. Make use of what they offer. And I thought, oh, that's inconvenient. I don't want to do that. See where the medical community is right. What they were saying is, we don't have all the answers. I didn't want that to be true, because I needed things to be clear. I needed things to be precise, and if I do this, I'll get the better. It will all work out. But I've stayed sober long enough now that the next gift that AA has given me is the freedom to live in the world too. Today I'm a member of a church where they call me and ask me questions. I did not darken the door of meetings that were in churches when I first got sober, because I didn't belong there and that was for other people. AA gave me a road to healing through that, and that's a long story that would take an hour to tell, and your story will be different than mine, but the willingness to look and seek came from here when I really started to listen. It gave me the opportunity to find a God that made sense to me and then learn more. You know, I learned how to take care of myself in sobriety. Not all the answers for health come out of here, including mental health, and I had some issues there too. And I had to take a look at those. And I grew up in an AA where if you were doing it right, you didn't really need that. If you were doing it right, then you should watch out for that whole psychiatric stuff. Be careful. And I thought seeking help in that realm would make me weak. It would make me less sober. What it's really done is free me up to find more answers to more questions that I had. What's really happened for me is that Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps that we use and the framework that I've been able to talk about tonight has created this wonderful foundation, and from it, all of this beautiful life has sprung. Everything is available to us. Everything. But I do keep this as the structure that I stand on. It is where I always come. It is where my favorite people are. It is where I find my balance and my center, and here I am just an alcoholic trying to get sober. And in that process, I get to be and do all these other things. And I'm reminded, and I'll say this and be quiet, reminded of, there's a line in the book that says, we're in the world to play the role He, God, whatever you think of that, assigns. Now, I don't know about y'all, but my channel was pretty choked up. I didn't know how to hear. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and the process of working them over and over and over again on every area of my life and then doing it again, what it's given me is a clear channel so that I can begin to hear what He wanted me to be all along. And in order to stay clear, I got to stay with you. And so it is an honor and privilege to be here tonight. Thank you so much. I think I have gone over. Like I said, I got all the words. But thank you for having me, and thank you for letting me share.
Chris, thank you so much. It was so honest. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speaker meeting tonight.
The girl.